actually don't have all that much to say. It's just that, so as some of you know, since I was denied reappointment, I've been sort of thinking about how to change the focus of my career. And one thing that I've been doing this year, during what's sort of my year off, is I'm starting an NGO, and the idea is to develop GIS software and to provide customized GIS technology and training to grassroots environmental organizations. And the initial focus has been on environmental organizations in developing countries. So I've been spending a lot of time thinking and reading about sustainability, and in particular, sustainability in international economic development. And I have to say that because a lot of people who work on sustainability are architects in the United States who are interested in green architecture, or city planners who are interested in designing cities in the developed world that have smaller ecological footprints. So when I say sustainability, I'm actually talking about the kind of sustainability that people have been talking about, at least since 1987. So the Brundtland Commission, which was commissioned by some UN something or other, I forget right now what it was, produced a report called Our Common Future, and people also just call it Brundtland Report, in which they laid out what they what they called sustainable development, which is just development that meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. So that's a direct quote. And the salient thing about this definition is that it puts two things in one sentence. That is, the needs of the present. And by the needs of the present, they were referring to the needs of the drastically, drastically poor in the less developed countries of the world. And the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. And that became interpreted as environmental, minimizing or eliminating environmental degradation that results from poverty elimination. These days, these needs of the poor have been, what most people think of when they think of the needs of the desperately poor are pretty well laid out in the UN Millennium Development Goals, which most people who are familiar with them, a lot of people are newly familiar with them. Did anybody see that movie, The Girl in the Cafe? Swarthy's are showing
up. Incoming.
Yeah. Oh, actually, Rob. Hey, Rob.
How you doing?
Oops.
We've gotten away from the UN Millennium Development Goals.
Yeah. So the UN Millennium Development Goals are these goals that the developed countries of the world have agreed to try to meet by the year 2015. And of course, progress has been very slow toward that. People are more and more pessimistic. But among them are things like eradicating extreme poverty and hunger. What they actually mean by that is they've said that means cutting in half the number of people who are dying of hunger and desperately poor.
It's an interesting use of the word eradicate.
Yeah, it is.
Achieving universal primary education. I did this wrong. So there should be a heading above these hollow circle points. But one of the points was really just achieving environmentally sustainable economic development. And these were the points, the sort of subheadings under that. I don't actually really need to talk about what sustainable development means in much detail. What I really am interested in is just sort of, we can just sort of accept that sustainable development is reducing the numbers of people who are desperately poor and hungry and malnourished, whatever, but doing so in a way that minimizes environmental degradation. All right, so sustainable development was first laid out in 87 by the Brundtland Report, and it was partly in response to the Green Revolution. So the Green Revolution was the gigantic development movement that really defined economic development for a few decades. So it really started in 1956 it started in Mexico. So Mexico, in 1956, Mexico had the state of its agricultural program was such that it was importing half of the wheat that it was consuming. The International Wheat Improvement Program, which was largely funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, set up the first of these agricultural improvement programs. So in developed countries around the world, you'll see these agricultural improvement programs. You'll see the maize improvement program in Mexico, the wheat improvement program in Mexico, which was the first of these. You'll see sago and rice improvement programs in Asia. The Mexico wheat program was so successful that in less than 10 years, Mexico was a net exporter of wheat. And the model that this established and which was copied around the world and which really drove the Green Revolution was this program of knowledge transfer from these advanced research centers to national agricultural research programs that turned the advanced research centers would develop high yield varieties of wheat or maize or rice. Sometimes these days they do it through recombinant DNA technology, but back then they did it mostly through just careful breeding. These varieties get transferred to the national agricultural research programs, which turn these varieties into agriculturally useful programs that they can disseminate to farmers through extension programs, and extension programs then sort of try to sell the farmers on these things. Now, I should say grain production. So these high yield varieties, along with the other things that were pushed by the Green Revolution, were enormously successful in increasing agricultural production per hectare of arable land. So nobody doubts that. And a lot of people credit the Green Revolution with saving millions of people from dying of starvation in the 60s and 70s. So again, the main way that the Green Revolution worked was by promoting high-yield genetic varieties, heavy use of chemical fertilizers, modernized irrigation techniques, heavy machinery, like, plows, I guess, tractors, and heavy use of pesticides and herbicides. And while it was enormously successful in producing food for hungry people, it had a lot of side effects. Or actually, I'm dividing this somewhat arbitrarily into side effects and scale effects, just because it's rhetorically useful for later. Farmers became enormously dependent on petrochemicals, so chemical fertilizers, and also fuel for the heavy machinery. Soil fertility is believed to have decreased a lot in a lot of these newly intensified agricultural land.
Because they weren't rotating, or because they were not letting land lie fallow for anything?
It was mostly monoculture.
Yeah, so there's no crop rotation, but also because of irrigation.
Washing away a lot of that.
And of course the washing away of the fertilizer results in pollution of groundwater and downstream stream water.
And did all of these, that whole list, depend on the development of high-yield genetic varieties? I mean, you only described that as what was being developed in the national research program. So did the use of chemical fertilizers, irrigation, et cetera, all
They don't all depend on that, no, but there was a similar knowledge transfer model for promoting the use of all these other things. It's especially the National Agricultural Research Program. So they, this would be where the high yield variety notion would be integrated with these other notions, promoting the use of heavy machinery and modernized irrigation, that sort of thing.
And were these top-down research centers sort of in developed world, in the developed world? I assume that we're not talking about the centers actually existing and developing these high-yield genetic varieties in the third world itself. Just Monsanto and people like that that are...
Well, so I think you have to sort of see the top level of this as being possibly based in developed countries, but they are very much part of the first world academic, industrial, agricultural complex. So they go to the same conferences and do the same kind of research. They send postdocs all over. I have a good friend who's a postdoc now at Penn, and he just recently came from doing a postdoc at the Mexico Maize Improvement Center.
I see.
So it's been very much.
But they actually locate. I mean, it's not.
Yeah.
They do locate them in these countries.
Yeah.
But they're just tied into the general network.
Yeah.
There are two levels, as Ted showed. There's a top level, which is largely first world and largely academic. But then, as a part of the thing, there are national sectors created under the aegis of the global system.
And this was all done under the green.
This is all green revolution.
It doesn't seem very green.
Well, this is stuff that is sort of called by other people the green revolution. I mean, they didn't sort of set these things up and said we're part of the green revolution, and they didn't claim to be environmentalists. They claimed to be saving people from starvation.
Yeah,
but it is, ironically enough, was it the green revolution?
Yeah, you know, plants are green.
And I mean, and Norman Borlaug, who was a researcher, created many of these high-yield strains of wheat and wheat with short stems that can fall over and various things. I mean, you know,
He won a Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah, I mean, for...
Actually, now that I think about it, it's the green revolution, because the other revolution at the time was that...
That's true.
Oh, that's...
contrast with the social
right.
revolution.
So some of the other criticisms and many of these people usually put under the heading of social consequences are that farming in general in these developing countries becomes industrialized, corporatized. It meant the end of family farming for a lot of people. Crop biodiversity decreased, and a lot of the non-nitrogen fertilizers have to be mined, phosphorus, magnesium, that sort of thing. And did anybody hear this really amazing This American Life story about Nauru, this little Pacific Island country that had been just completely stripped of its upper layer just to get at the phosphorus? It was this amazing This American Life story about environmental destruction but also political corruption. So I recommend it. Just let that work. All right. So. Now, in general, when people talk about economic development that happened in the 50s through the 60s and 70s, only some of them are talking about the Green Revolution. Others are talking about all those big dam projects that the World Bank funded and road projects. But in general, they all face sort of similar classes of criticisms. And some of these criticisms are addressed by some of the sustainable development people. Sustainable development, people started talking about it in the mid-80s. It started getting popular through the 90s. And the main things that they talked about were integration and scale effects. So that's why I divided these into side effects and scale effects. I'm sort of subtly claiming that side effects are addressed by integration and scale effects are addressed by scale. First, I just wanted to mention something about integration. All of the big buzzwords that came about starting in the mid-80s and all through the 90s, the big buzzwords for new programs of sustainable development were largely about integration. That is, integrate, and by integration, I mean programs that addressed not only poverty reduction through growing better crops and that sort of thing, but also environmental consequences and social consequences at the same time. These are all buzzwords listed in this Sayer and Campbell book.
So is this just another word for system, thinking of it as in terms of a whole system, more systemically rather than just focusing on increasing?
Yes, yeah, definitely so. And people who talk about systems, at least in this sort of development world, were largely ecologists, and their groups here have an ecosystem in front of them. So, and if you look at some of the definitions the descriptions of these buzzwords by the people who used them, many of them say very much the same thing. Integrated natural resource management, and that was really just one of the first attempts to say we should look beyond agriculture, we should also look at the environment and economics. Catchment management and water resource management, these were attempts to say we can define a spatial, we can define a spatial scale by a biophysical, a natural biophysical delineation, which is the watershed. And within the watershed, we can look at everything that happens from growing crops through marketing of seeds.
Can I jump in for one second? A few years ago, under the auspices of the Environmental Studies Program, a speaker came in who's an anthropologist who reported on water management practices, and I think it was in Indonesia, where there was this structure of the basically the local temples, the priests sort of managed all the water. And what happened was when the Green Revolution came in, they broke apart the whole system of management, and for a very short period of time yields went up, and then the breakdown of water management meant that the whole system imploded. So the argument was you have to sort of restore that kind of management, where it turned out they were doing a really good job of parceling out water to individual farms and things like that. So it was a really good example of how a pre-existing structure was working, and then the large-scale introduced system didn't work.
I think Jim talked about that in this group, in fact.
Yeah, Jim Wright will be able to talk about
right.
that also. And the other reason that people are really interested in water is that because water is used in agriculture, and because water is what carries pollutants, and because water flows throughout the entire system, water is a natural integrator, and it carries in it natural indicators of environmental degradation. And so the idea was if you focus management on this natural integrator, you're going to be naturally integrating your management practices. When I was in forestry school in the mid-90s, the big deal was integrated conservation and development programs, ICDPs. And the notion here was to integrate environmental with economic concerns by promoting things that that provide an economic benefit for conservation. So this, so the main things here were ecotourism and non-timber forest products, and landscape management is another kind of interesting one. The notion here is that if you look across a landscape, so a landscape is going to include many catchments, many different land use types. It's going to include farms and sort of residential clusters and maybe even cities. If you can integrate management across all these different land use types, then you can you don't have to optimize for multiple objectives within a land use type. That can be very difficult. You can allow there to be some specialization. You can let the farmers be farmers as long as their environmental, their negative environmental consequences can be mitigated by neighboring land use types.
So this may be where you're going with this, but this all sounds massively top down.
Yeah, so.
What's even more interesting is not only is it massively top down, but you find me to get direction properly. The problem wasn't only that it was massively top down, it's that the top down influence was concerned only with a single variable, with a multivariate system.
You mean in the Green Revolution?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I meant even this though, which presumably, this is 2004, right?
Yeah.
So this is the critique of the Green Revolution in a sense, but it still has to be top down.
Yeah, but my point, maybe gets to, let's see, there are actually two ways, I mean, if you read the Green Revolution as having had a problem, there are two ways to define the problem. One way to define the problem is that it was largely top-down management. The other way to define the problem is it was focused too much on a single variable in a multivariable system. The reason to distinguish the two possibilities are if you conceive it to have been a top-down problem, then your effort is to reduce top-down influences. If you perceive it to have been a failure to appreciate a large number of interacting variables, then you might still go with a top-down system, but you insist on going with one that has a measure of the integrated variables. And that's what Ted is suggesting with regard to water. If, in fact, the issue had focused not on crop productivity, but on water quality, there is at least the suggestion that water as a phenomenon integrates a large number of variables.
So
see where Ted wants to go.
So I agree that integration is a step in the right direction. So that all these things were a step in the right direction, and some of them failed because they were still very top down. The integrated natural resource management, for one, was actually one. I think that was the one. No, integrated rural development was a big deal in the 60s, and the main criticism that people have of that is that it was very much based on this notion that Western science knows best, and we're going to figure out how to integrate all these things and inform everybody else how these things can be done. But it does address this issue of things like Green Revolution that I would call the Green Revolution a sort of a reductionist or analytical approach, in that it really tries to boil things down to how do we deal with this. One problem, which is agriculture.
Can I just add something though? Because I think there's a critical difference between conceptualization and revolution, needless to say. And it's one thing to conceptualize things systemically. It's another thing to attempt to change things by imposing a top-down action program upon the individuals who are actually doing the farm, for example. And it seems to me that this, at a conceptual level, there's absolutely nothing wrong with all of the things that you have up there. That it's very useful, and clearly that counteracts the sort of single variable orientation of the Green Revolution. But if what you're trying to do is bring about change, the interesting question is whether you can impose change, even when you think about it systemically, from the top down, or whether or not you have to obviously operate from the bottom up, or both.
Yeah, and I think that what you'll hear a lot of people these days who are trying to do these sort of things, what you hear a lot of them say is that you can't draw that line, that that conceiving of a new way of, say, integrating objectives in some sort of development program has to include the selling to people, or not selling it to people, but the big talk these days is in participatory development, and they see the participatory element of that as being sort of, you know, the same sort of innovation as the integration.
These are theories in some sense.
Yeah, and so actually this one here, this adaptive collaborative management, so that's sort of closest to what some of the people who are, that's probably one of the newer buzzwords that people are getting excited about these days. You hear the word participatory bandied about a lot. And of course, there are still the criticisms that while development agencies claim to want participation on the part of the local people, that they only want so much participation, they don't want true participation. But yeah, there is this concept, they have come up with this notion that it's a good thing, and there's still the issue of how
But if you think of it sort of by analogy to New York City and housing projects and whatever her name is that wrote that great book.
Jane Jacobs.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of, it's not that you, what you have to do is create structures which make local decision making possible.
Yeah.
You can't, even, you can't just sort of say, hey, we want you to collaborate, and by the way, this is how you have to do it.
Yeah.
And that seems to me to be the critical question. How do you go about creating those kind of structures that people really feel empowered, and they really are empowered, in fact, to have some influence on the system?
I think that's a very interesting question, but it's not clear to me that at the moment the argument has been made that that's what's needed in this case.
Well, we'll see. I'm not really sure.
I want you to go back about three levels, and I guess, no, I mean conceptually. You don't have to go back up. I'm actually wanting to look at the phrase sustainable development. Was there some philosophizing done when that term evolved about the oxymoronic quality of sustainable development? I mean, when Rob said the point is to bring about change, I thought, well, the point is to both enable change but enable a kind of stability or homeostasis. I mean, what's interesting about sustainable development is you want to develop products, make people be less poor, but you have a long-term goal of sustainability. And part of the problem of participatory development, I expect, is that people are too local in their notions of what it is they need. So tearing down the rainforest so that you can have money to live,
yeah,
but not thinking globally about the effects on the planet.
Yeah.
I think
that it's worth noting that this early definition of sustainable development is kind of a negative definition. It was really written in response to bad things. It wasn't,
uh-huh,
you know, it wasn't a definition that proposed a plausible way forward. It was just saying we should stop wrecking the environment when we do these sort of things. And
fairness, it was even more than that. What you have to remember is there were two political communities that had separate histories. There's the social welfare political community scaled up to the international scale. The leftovers of communism, the left-wing community that says that too many people on earth were poor. On the other hand, you have a developing community of tree huggers. Political problem becomes how do you put the tree huggers and the leftover communists together? Sustainable development is the theory that allows the tree huggers and the leftover communists to work together.
And this other issue, Anne, that you bring up about people who want to burn down their part of the rainforest so that they have money. I would sort of put that under the heading of scale problems.
Okay.
Or people might also just call those things negative externalities.
Well, I think it's another way of talking about multivariable systems, but what I'm thinking about is local and global.
Mm-hmm.
Remember when Paul brought Paul Ehrlich to campus?
I wasn't here.
And he
though.
Introduced me to him in the bookstore, and I said, I read The Population Bomb in a poli-sci class in 1969. I feel very guilty, but I had four children who didn't convince me. And part of it was, I mean, I was totally convinced by the argument that it was a very bad thing for me to have four children, but
yeah,
my sense of my own emotional investments and what I wanted for my own life didn't extend to thinking about the effect of having those four children on the planet.
Yeah, and Paul is very much a product of this sort of 60s era environmentalism.
Yeah. Sure.
I mean, and it wasn't just the pocket, I mean, the criticism of him was that the policies that he advocated would, result in these draconian, these awful authoritarian measures. But even his conservation biology stuff really is about this sort of biosphere person kind of thinking that says there's this global crisis and we'll do what has to be done to avert this global crisis without very careful thinking about how to port that downscale to...
And without thinking about development. I mean, wasn't there a point when there was
That's
just
the
thinking
point.
About
so
sustainability,
Ehrlich,
not
Ehrlich
development?
Ehrlich is actually a very good example of this. Ehrlich was a tree hugger. And Ehrlich started taking very heavy flack from the communists because by being a tree hugger, he was advocating policies that were, as far as the communists. central to the masses.
Okay, go on to scale.
Yeah, so scale. Scale's one of these things that doesn't get talked about as much in terms of scale. People don't use the word scale when they do their studies. But more and more people are. Okay, so this is just some article and then clicked on it because there was a table. This wasn't the table that I wanted, so never mind. But there is this growing acknowledgement in the academic end of these sort of integrated development studies that most studies that take place do take place in a very clearly defined scale and don't account for things that happen at the larger scale. So some of the consequences of scale-naive thinking that come out of that Sarah and Campbell book, these are just things that are suggested. For example, improved plot-level water use efficiency. So if you measure water use efficiency at the level of a plot, and it's very commonly done, may not lead to the improved water use at the level of the entire irrigation system. Changes in land use or crop management on hillsides may not have easily predictable consequences when you look downstream. And this one is sort of one that sort of is similar to this rainforest example, where individual fishing behaviors may optimize fishing for an individual, but would have negative externalities, tragedy of the commons type consequences for the entire fishery.
It's a shame that our economic representation isn't here this morning, because of course, you know, I mean, I think he's said on more than one occasion that Adam Smith's whole point of view, I'm summarizing poor Adam Smith in one sentence here, but was that fundamentally selfish decisions made at the personal level have social utility. And this obviously is just the reverse of that, right? That you can't, if you have individuals making fundamentally personal and selfish decisions to increase their own livelihood, that it actually has negative social utility.
Yeah, but what
the
economists...
Yeah, the other implication, getting back to this issue of top-down management, is the implication is that you have to have some top-down integration. Otherwise, you end up with these scale-related problems.
Well, if this
you
is
can't,
true,
right.
That's assuming that these are, in fact, demonstrable effects at the system level.
They are demonstrable effects at the system level, so take it to another more obvious case. When departments in a university or college end up acting solely in terms of their local departmental interests, there are demonstrably undesirable effects on the function of institutions. Adam Smith was half right. He was not all right. Smith didn't actually say, in fairness to him, he didn't say that all local decision making will be socially advantageous. He said there are social phenomena which result from individual decision making. He left open the question of whether they were necessarily advantageous.
Yeah, and I'm not sure I would agree with your point either, by the way. I think it's an open question as to whether if you had a university or a college in which every department sought to maximize its quality with the best possible people and the best possible courses and the best possible teaching and the best possible students, and they were thrown into competition for resources, that in fact you wouldn't necessarily have a worse institution.
I agree that we differ in our...
And in fact, I think I could point to some institutions which have been like that and are very, very, very well renowned as a result. University of Chicago, for example.
Healthy systems. Let's forget renown. Let's talk about sustainable development.
But I agree there's a point of concern there, but then let me simply say I think the same point of concern applies across all situations.
I mean, that is actually, you just argued against yourself. I mean, if you think
by citing the University of Chicago.
Well, if you think about the hiring wars, I mean,
if we are talking about sustainable development, I mean, if we're talking about a healthy intellectual ecosystem, either universities where departments are in competition or universities that are in competition, I don't know.
I think it will turn out in the long run. After several weeks of waiting, it will turn out to be using different criteria for healthy intellectual system.
Yeah.
Well, that's another issue, of course. And but that's equally true here, right? I mean,
yes,
you have to specify
what
the criteria are.
So in in 1978, this guy named Holling proposed the notion of adaptive management, and adaptive management has been latched onto by a lot of managers and people who think about land management as a way of getting around the issue of the difficulties of figuring out how to work out exactly how to integrate objectives and how to deal with scale issues. So you hear adaptive management talked a lot about in things like forestry programs, say in the 90s. And the notion is that all management decisions go through this process of assessing the problem, coming up with a solution, implementing a solution, and monitoring, evaluating, and changing these solutions so that they go around in a cycle. The analogy is to sort of old-fashioned scientific method. And the analogy is very explicit in that the idea is that every management decision is an experiment. So we're going to experiment on ourselves. We're going to try this new management technique, some new irrigation method, some new variety of wheat, and do it over and over again, and constantly improve.
I guess the problem I have with that notion is, I mean, I think in theory it sounds good, but in practice there are going to be decisions where you sort of let the genie out of the bottle and you can't put the genie, you know, if you build a dam,
that's
take away the dam if it doesn't work.
Well, yeah, so that's of course one problem is that you're limited in the sort of magnitude of decisions that you're likely to feel comfortable making. The other thing is it's just hard to get sort of local farmers to agree to just experiment at all on what they're doing. There's a lot of traditional knowledge about what works best.
Let me flag something that Karen said because I think it's important. There are a number of ways to get this conclusion that adaptive management is a good idea. It's closely related to a set of arguments. Is an adaptive management system. Karen's concern is a very interesting challenge. If you accept the idea that an adaptive management system is, as you described it, a process of continuing experimentation, Karen is saying because some experiments are so potentially dangerous, you're restrained doing them. And I would say that in fact, rather than that being a challenge to the adaptive management idea, that should be regarded as a virtue of the adaptive management idea. Once you get it in your mind that every management decision is an experiment, it in fact is a very strong check against implementing certain policies.
That can be reversible.
Anticipate have a sufficiently uncertain outcome of sufficiently great magnitude, and you simply don't do them.
Well,
but you could then argue that what you've done is set up a very strongly risk-averse system.
No, it
and
be strongly risk-averse. How risk-averse it's going to be depends on your threshold for what you accept as a potentially useful outcome.
I mean, we shouldn't have built those dams. That's true.
Well, if you add simulation, though, it opens up the doors.
Yeah. So, but before that, I just want to make this one point that one thing that you can take from adaptive management, even if you don't want to experiment a whole lot, is that a management program that emphasizes adaptiveness emphasizes learning, but even more important, it emphasizes the development of a decision support infrastructure, very clear assessment methods and development of a decision-making process that can very often include things like negotiation and mediation skills, and in general, it focuses more on the process of making decisions rather than on what those decisions are going to be. That's a key way that that modern integrated development programs are trying to move away from a top-down approach to a participatory approach by de-emphasizing the actual knowledge and placing much more emphasis on how you get the local people to do these things for themselves, although in very Western ways.
What also seems key is that best bet is to build ability to adapt to change. I mean, that idea of not making decisions that aren't reversible or themselves adaptable. That feels really.
But there's
key.
Another. I mean, it
can I inject something real quick? We need to make a decision. We have about 8 minutes, and Ted isn't halfway through. I can tell by your little slider on the side.
Oh, you know what? I can rush. Okay.
Oh, well, would you be willing to talk next week, or?
I don't
want to
come back next week.
Okay, so we should finish.
Then. All right, then I won't.
Okay.
But it's that much is all pictures.
Okay.
And there's not that much to say about the pictures.
All right.
This is this nifty thing that I think is relevant. But mostly, I think it's really interesting. And whoa, how that happened. And so this is from some stuff I've been reading in the theory of video games, and in particular, the stuff by this guy named Gonzalo Frasca, who's a game designer, and he is pushing for what he, though he didn't coin the term, what he calls ludology, which is to games what narratology is to narratives. All right. So he's making this point that how most people think about how people have approached video games and how everybody thinks of novels and that sort of thing is in terms of representation. But games aren't about representation; they're about simulation. Right? So in his example, you think of a movie of an airplane landing, and in the movie, the airplane's going to land, and you can watch it, and you can interpret it however you want. And that's going to be fundamentally different. It's going to be categorically different from, say, a flight simulator, in which what's actually fixed is not the behavior of the plane, but the rules that govern the behavior of the plane. Another example he gives is Germinal by Zola is about a strike. A mining strike. There is also a depiction of a representation of a mining strike, of a strike of janitors in the movie Bread and Roses. And he's sort of interested in how these are two narratives about strikes that have very different endings. One ends happily, one ends tragically. And in his mind, in Frasca's mind, it's really just the author sort of can decide what happens. But what if you were interested in strikes, the dynamics of strikes? What would you, how would you be able to represent that? He sort of suggests, well, you know, maybe you could write a narrative. You could write five different narratives, and the reader could take an average and get the probability distribution of outcomes of strikes. All right. Well, how I think this is relevant is a lot of the talk about economic development has sort of was traditionally very narrative. It used a lot of metaphors. One of the more famous metaphors was countries are like cars of a train, and economic development levels are like stations. So, the first cars of the train are going to pull through prosperity, high levels of development, and they're going to pull behind them the lesser developed countries, which are going to move through the same sequence of economic development levels. So there was this notion that there's a story that describes how this thing is going to work for all these countries. This sort of narrative, metaphor-driven notion of development fits in very well with the top-down model by which knowledge is transferred from the first world into the third world. And if development can move from thinking of economic growth in terms of a narrative, and instead think of it in terms of simulation, then all right, then it opens the door even wider for more participatory approaches. So that's just a sort of nifty way of bringing up this thing that I wanted to introduce you all to, which is this Frost guy's notion of ludology. But there's also a concrete way of thinking about simulation. And I'm going to skip over the Zimbabwe study, just because if you read through it, it's actually kind of stupid. It's not stupid, but it's not very simulation. It was really just the development of a belief network, an explicit belief network in which participants, which were all representatives of villages, were asked, what are the important issues in grazing management? And they were asked, what are the states of the possible inputs? And they developed probability distributions of the different states. And the whole thing ended up being an exercise in getting everybody to sit around and talk about and agree on what are the important issues. So that's important and that's interesting. But what I'm a little more interested in was this project in Senegal, where the problem was that there was a conflict between farmers and cattle raisers, in particular with reference to water rights. So what they did was they got a bunch of farmers and cattle ranchers together, and they did an exercise in which they did a little role-playing game in which they drew a map and they used post-it notes to describe land use. They said, all right, if I put a farm, you know, some cropland here, what'll you do with your cattle? That sort of thing. And from this role-playing game, they developed, they sort of codified the behaviors into an easy little algorithm, like a little flowchart algorithm, in which in each iteration, the decisions about where to move the cows, where to put the cropland, were put into a form that could easily be implemented in a computer simulation. And then they put it into a computer simulation, and they ran the computer simulation over and over again with slight modifications to the decision making and to the initial conditions. So in this example, here's an initial state of where the water is, and I don't know what the colors represent, but I mean, the colors represent different land uses and soil types, and I assume the dots and diamonds represent densities of the different and intensities of the different land uses. And after many iterations, this is at the end of the year, they would end up with what's the final state of the distribution of land use types. As a result of these simulations, they were able to run through many different kind of configurations of the decisions and the actual rules that the farmers and ranchers would sort of set for each other and for their own behaviors, and they ended up settling on rules that seemed to work, that had to do with the farmers are allowed to grow their crops right by the water as long as they leave corridors for the cattle to access the water and that sort of thing. So the rules of interaction among the players in the simulation end up being decodified and turned into these informal actual rules for interaction between the actual people who have to share this land. So that's all I have to say. I mean, my sort of last questions, which we don't really have time to talk about, are...
And is that the kind of model you want for your business now, that you're going to go...
So this NGO that I'm starting
is... Puts little I think that's a really interesting way.
Yeah, right? But no.
No, okay.
No, I mean... Later, maybe, but
okay.
For now, it's really just about providing GIS.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Which fits into this notion of the decision.
That would be just one tool at some point that
yeah.
could be used. All right.
Yeah, and GIS is easily integrated into this sort of spatially explicit simulation.
Yeah.
But the main thing is to give people tools for understanding what their land management issues are and what their options are.
Well, I see your labile versus static story here again. Narratives versus simulations are another cut there.
Except that there's still a narration in the simulation. I mean, there's a decision of how things affect each other, and you have to build those into the simulation.
But that's where the bottom up comes in, I think. That's where that's going to be contextual, and you have to really get those narratives from the people first. I would argue that it would be more efficient that way than a top-down narrative. When we oppose our Western view of what was going to work, I don't know if that's...
So when people play the game, they take the role of the humans in the simulation and they make decisions on every iteration?
Yeah, I think what they do is they set the initial conditions and then they let it play out. And then they see how it plays out and then they make a slight modification to the underlying simulation rules to see how this new set of simulation rules ends up for everybody.
But every loop, somebody has to make a decision for the humans.
Each it's an agent-based simulation.
Okay.
And so each agent has a set of rules which are, you know, which the people will modify between runs, but not between iterations.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, it's intention. To go back to the problem of local and global, the fundamental problem is what I'll ignore is when individuals make choices, part of the background in which they're making choices is a set of global variables which they don't realize are variables.
Yeah.
What can be done with a set of simulations like this is to show people, to show individuals, the background of global variables on which their own success depends, and the ability of that background of global variables. And so you could, by using simulations like this, potentially get individuals to become more aware of the global variable background against which they're acting, and hence to improve their local decision making.
So it's not just global-local, it's actually the variability on the global scale.
No, it's in a sense, it's compartmentalization or transparency or lack thereof.
I mean, I think the other thing that it really, that this kind of modeling suggests is the, as Ted's already alluded to, the importance of community involvement. So you have to get individual people not to operate only as individuals, but as to operate as part of the community. So in other words, whatever mechanisms are brought in, it has to strengthen the social connections within a population, because otherwise there's no incentive for an individual to act in any way other than just for his or her immediate benefit.
Yeah,
and so
these see what you're saying, it is a potential solution to the Adam Smith problem, but it's a potential solution that depends not on individuals becoming more caring about other individuals or any other time. It depends on showing individuals that their own well-being depends on variables which they don't think they're influencing, but in fact are. And the really good example of this is one of the really striking things about the flooding in New Orleans was the number of people in New Orleans who said, "There is no flooding in my house. There's no reason for me to leave." In fact, the people were unaware that there was a large infrastructure on which their own well-being depends that had been destroyed by the flood. So a person could be sitting there in their own house, there's no water, there's no apparent threat. The person's unaware that they actually depend on an effective fire department, that they depend on an effective electrical distribution system, that they depend on somebody monitoring water quality. There are a whole series of global variables which individuals don't think they influence, and which individuals are unaware affect. affects their well-being. A simulation like this can help people discover these apparently fixed global variables that they don't think they have any control over,
yeah.
and discover their influence on them.
And even more important, an exercise like this is structured through which they can do that more in the future.
That's
you know, it's a way for them to have more of these exercises.
That's
But that they won't. Those variables have to be built into the model.
Oh, absolutely.
So
no.
there's nothing. That
no, they don't actually have to be built into the model.
Well,
it's
so
it's
so
an
the
emergence
the
thing.
The example that I skipped over.
Because of the model.
In the example that I skipped over, they didn't really end up implementing a simulation based on it. They just went through the first part of the exercise, which was deciding what all the interactions are. You know, what are the actors? What are the processes that we have to pay attention to, and how do they impact each other? And the authors sort of claimed unconvincingly that even that was really useful.
Yeah, I believe that would be useful, but I guess I also believe that, let's say before Hurricane Katrina, you may have built a model of New Orleans and run your little simulation and not ended up with the results that we ended up with.
Yeah.
So I guess there's another layer or another level that I'd like to see that go where even the model builders can learn something about.
The model builders don't actually need to know anything because they're first worlders, and as you remember, first worlders basically know how everything should work.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
That's a really interesting thing.
Well, thank you, Ted.
Yes.
How do I stop? This one?
Yeah.